Welcome to the Surviving Grief Podcast, hosted by our grief ministry leaders at Crossroads Church. We'll be sitting down with friends as they share their powerful stories of loss and healing, and we'll hear from grief professionals and other wise people with useful tools for our own time of grief. If you're supporting someone who's grieving, you'll learn how to comfort them and walk with them on their own path to healing. Let's join the conversation.
So in the discussions of perspectives on the grief process, we talked about a lot of things that are going to be true in special problems in grief. The things we're going to talk about now tonight don't replace those. But there are some special situations that are worth at least mentioning. The first one is a sudden death, an unexpected death. Unexpected deaths happen as a result of accidents of various sorts, crimes, acts of war, medical emergencies nobody knew was coming. When death is expected, for instance, when it's been clear that somebody's body has been getting ready to say goodbye, it doesn't make it easy, but you at least have more opportunity to say or do last things or finish unfinished business with the person who's dying. Conversations, messages in that kind of situation might include apologies, expressions of love, appreciation, explanations sometimes, reconciliations, things like that. But in an unexpected death, there's been no time to prepare for the loss or to finish any unfinished business with the person who's died. If you're grieving a sudden death and there is unfinished business between you and the deceased, there aren't any easy 1, 2, 3 answers here because each situation is so different, but I would absolutely encourage you to share your concerns with a trusted confidant. And you might even eventually want to check into some counseling to help you resolve unfinished business that is staying on your mind and in your heart and plaguing you throughout the day, keeping you awake at night, those kind of things. Please don't do yourself the disservice of just sitting on it yourself. Please offer yourself the freedom of honestly and safely walking through it. So that's just a few thoughts about unexpected death, sudden death. Another special problem, of course, is suicide. There are several additional or more intense issues when somebody has died by suicide. First of all, in addition to the loss itself, suicide can be viewed as an accusation against a survivor. I wasn't good enough to stay alive for. The bereaved person can also feel more personally responsible or guilty about the death because it somehow seems more preventable. And so when we were talking about the value and the importance of anger when we walked through the perspectives on the basic grief process, anger can be more intensely turned in against oneself because of the dynamic. And the bargaining stage we talked about can take the form of, why didn't I notice something was that wrong? Also with suicide, if there were previous attempts or threats, the bereaved could have become weary of dealing with them and not have believed the potential for an actual suicide was real or an actual success likely. Anger turned inward and bargaining can be affected in that kind of situation. Lastly, there's a greater stigma attached to suicide, and so there is less apparent freedom to express thoughts and feelings throughout the grief process. There's a greater tendency, inclination to just keep them inside and dwell on them yourself, just because of the stigma. Oh, your loved one died. How'd they die? They took their own life. Let's go on to something else. it's harder to talk about because of the stigma. So if you're a griever of a suicide, I want to encourage you, just like in the other special situations here, to give yourself the gift of finding someone to talk about these things with and to not just hold those back. Another special problem can have to do with secrets learned or learned about the deceased after the death, or otherwise knowing a secret about the deceased that no one else knows. At the risk of offending people who don't like country music of any kind, there is a real, real old country western song that is worth looking up on Spotify or Apple Music or wherever you can find it. It's by an old singer named Porter Wagoner. It's called Carroll County Accident. And it tells the story of one of the survivors learning a secret about a person who died in that accident. It's worth a listen, even if you can have trouble tolerating electric steel guitars or whatever. It's worth a listen. Every situation in this category is going to be really unique, so I would have to encourage anybody in the position of knowing or learning a secret to find an uninvolved confidant with whom to discuss it. There are a couple of deaths in my own past after which I learned things that, to my knowledge, no one else knows. One was in the course of a professional-type relationship. One was from a much more personal context. Both affected me significantly. And in both cases, I found confidants with whom I could share and process my reactions. And that helped me significantly to know that what I needed to talk about was not going to go any further under any circumstances. Another special situation, this is a tough one, the death of a child. While the death of a parent is to some extent the loss of the past, and the death of a spouse, sibling, or friend is the loss of the present, the death of a child is the loss of the future. If you're grieving the death of a child, just realizing this element can help you better understand and manage your reactions. And if somebody's listening who's helping someone grieve the death of a child, understanding this element can help you care for them more effectively, understand what they're going through more effectively. I would add that miscarriage and stillbirth both certainly fit into this category. And those very tough losses also fit and transition us right into the next category of special problems in grief, which is finally disenfranchised grief. What does disenfranchised mean? It means my voice is not being heard. I'm not feeling heard. I'm not feeling understood. Clinical psychologist by the name of Justin Ross says about the isolating feeling of disenfranchised grief, we use that term when the loss of something may not be widely understood. And well, he refers to it in a non-death situation. He refers to it being an operation when, say, a marathon runner fails to meet a heavily sought-after goal in a particular race. And you could think of any athlete in any situation like that. And others he or she is trying to explain the loss to, they just don't get it. There are many, many other situations we could describe as disenfranchised grief. Miscarriage can certainly include disenfranchised grief because others may not appreciate how devastating a loss that can be, and say things that just aren't really helpful at all after something like that. When you're experiencing disenfranchised grief and people you are in contact with just don't get it, please do not give up into resignation, into discouragement and loneliness. Please keep reaching out and seeking out people who will get it. They are out there. You have just not found them yet. And they are worth finding. Maybe the most recent mass example of disenfranchised grief has to do with the over 1 million Americans who have died from complications of COVID-19. According to the New York Times, more Americans have died of COVID-19 than in two decades of car crashes or on battlefields in all our country's wars combined. In the words of pastor and columnist Tish Harrison Warren, "The magnitude of the loss is overwhelming. Every person who died represents a community, a family, or a group of friends who will never be the same. The extent of the sorrow this number represents cannot be graphed or measured. We are left with inarticulate horror." She continued, "Since the beginning of the pandemic, many have noted the striking lack of communal mourning and staggering death tolls. This is in part because of the nature of the virus itself. But those who died often died alone, without friends or family around them. For much of the pandemic, before vaccines were widely available, we could not meet en masse for funerals. Many of the religious rituals we embrace in loss and grief were interrupted by social distancing or our attempts to prevent yet more death. National tragedies such as the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Challenger explosion were observed by collective rituals of public grief. But not so much the COVID-19 deaths, and most of us knew somebody, or at the very least knew of someone who died with COVID-19. So those are some special problems in grief. And again, all the things that we talked about in the perspectives on the grief process are involved in these, as well as these additional elements.
That's great. Thanks for sharing all of those, Mark. You know, one thing that you talked about is don't give up. Right? Your people are out there. They may not be in your immediate circle, or they may currently be grieving that same loss themselves. And so there's this gap there. If they are looking for professional help, a counselor, a therapist, a psychologist, because this is a question that we do get a fair amount, if they have no experience in that world, how do they find a grief counselor outside of just pulling something up in a phone book? Do you have any kind of recommendations of finding a pairing of a counselor or a therapist that is conducive to you?
That's a great question, because this is going to shock anybody who hears this, but in master's degree programs and doctoral programs in counseling, grief is very seldom mentioned. It's not talked about. There are postgraduate seminars on grief and things like that, but it's not discussed. It wasn't when I was trained back in the day, and the interns I supervise now tell me, no, it's still not covered. So that's a great question. And what you want to do is, it's going to take a little bit of telephone time or however you contact a counselor. Ask straight up front, how much experience do you have in grief intervention? I've done a little bit of that. Yeah, it's probably not where you... Yes, I do a lot of that, or I've worked with a lot of grief situations. It's not a guarantee. It's you can have a little more confidence going into that, but do some asking first before you schedule your first appointment.
Yeah, and also kind of, you know, encouraging people to have the freedom of, if it's not working out, don't stay there.
Right.
You know, like, right. Sometimes there's like this misplaced loyalty of, well, I'm going, but I'm not getting anything out of it, or they don't have experience. And so there's this idea of, oh, I need to stick it out. Well, not always, right? There's a relationship there also. There needs to be a trust.
And that's the most important part of any therapy, is the quality of relationship between the helper and the person who's looking for help. You will typically know within a session or two if this is going to feel like a match. If you go a couple of times and it just, you're not feeling comfortable, or you're for reason or reasons, maybe even unknown, there's just not a connection happening. Thank the person and move on. Go on to somebody else.
That's refreshing to hear, Mark. So I appreciate that. And, you know, as you went through this list of special problems, I just know that people are listening to this and there's this sigh of relief of, oh, it's not just me. You know, when you were talking about the sudden death and you were listing, you know, whether it was a crime or an act of war or, you know, a sudden medical issue, you know, for some people, there's this, oh, that's me.
Yes.
That's my story.
Yes.
You know, so one thing that we hear a lot in our Crossroads grief groups around sudden death, specifically, let's say, around crime or a violent loss, similar to some of the stigmas that you referred to with suicide, there is a certain stigma, especially if there's an ongoing court case or there's a lot of news media coverage around it. I know that we've had people in the past where here locally in Cincinnati, their story is splashed on the news. And, you know, when they share in a group, everybody is suddenly very familiar with their story. And so when it is hyper-focused or there's a lot of attention on a loss like that, how do you recommend they start that process of healing when they're in a spotlight that they may not necessarily want?
Yeah, the embarrassment, the publicness of it, emphasize the privacy of the group. There's a group that I lead that doesn't have anything to do with the grief. It's in a whole different realm that carries pretty significant stigma with it. We are on a first name basis only, and we ask people to agree to ground rules before we admit them to the group, that if you recognize somebody in the group and, oh, I know who that is, a public figure, and if it's in the news, you just became a public figure. If you recognize somebody as a public figure, I know who that is. You keep that knowledge to yourself. The anonymity and the privacy of every person in the group is that important. And that kind of group, I'd recommend being on first names only, not last names. And if you know somebody's going to share like that in a group, that you reemphasize that ground rule before that meeting, or at the beginning of that meeting. This is not a place for the helper to get their own needs met. I really am somebody because this person came. If you're grieving in a situation like this and you start to pick that up from the other person, that they're really feeling good about this because they're the person you chose, I think I'd just politely smile and shake hands and thank them and move on without apology. That's maybe that's a hard statement there, but I every person who's walking through that kind of situation where they're the knowledge of their loss is public deserves the respect of and is worth the respect of being taken seriously for themselves, not for some other motive or or payoff, if you will. We mentioned in the general discussion of the stages of grief, the podcast we did on that we talked about the how long does the grief process go, and we said something like, oh gosh, anywhere from 8 months to 2.5 years, and that's not meant to be hard boundaries on that. But that's not true in a situation where there's been a crime and there's been an arrest and there's a trial. Well-meaning people, when the conviction is finally obtained, and maybe the sentence is even before the appeals, the conviction's obtained and well-meaning people will say, oh, they'll pat the grieving person on the back, say, oh, now you can get this behind you. No, no, no. That is when that 8 month, 2.5 year or so process begins. That's when that clock starts, because you're not really walking through your grief when you're walking through arrests and trials and things like that.
Another question in that same violent loss where there's a trial, things like that. We have a lot of people question and ask, and they almost get fixated on the individual who committed the crime and their story and their evolution behind bars. And for some people, it takes on the form of forgiveness, and suddenly they're like pen pals, and it's this like new relationship. And then other people, it's this rooted anger and bitterness, because that's the person. They're responsible. They took my loved one away from me. Right? And so there's kind of, they vacillate between these two really big extremes of forgiveness and anger. But in the interim of that immediate grief bubble, let's say those first few months where maybe the trial hasn't even started yet, but they're just kind of left with the trauma, the violence of the loss.
Everything's suspended at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. If you could kind of talk more about that, about kind of, because the feelings are the same as other types of loss, and yet they're very heightened too because of the trauma, because of the violence. So for someone who finds themselves fixated on that one person who committed the crime, as opposed to the loved one that they lost, or even their own healing journey, and how would you encourage that person if they're stuck there?
Honor all your emotions. When you're fixated on anger, let yourself feel that. Express it in safe ways, in safe places. I hate to have to add this, but I think I would try to stay off social media with those things. Speak with confidants. Speak with people that you know not only you can trust, but will honor the emotions that you're feeling. When there's that kind of a fixation on anger, I've had to deal with some very significant anger over several things in my past, and I think there are safe ways to do that. I have a punching bag out in my garage. I have a heavy bag. Used to be in our basement in our old house, and I use it sometimes. I don't use it as often now as I once did when I was, and I expect there'll be times when I'm going to use it again. Put on the bag gloves and go at it. And I don't edit how hard I hit, and I don't edit what I say when I'm doing that. The garage door is down. Nobody else is hearing that. And I just want to emphasize encourage the genuineness of expression. I have hit so hard and so long that my fists are numb, and I haven't known until I've pulled the gloves off that my knuckles are bloody. That's genuine rage, and that's a safe way to get it out. For somebody who doesn't like to hit, I know someone who played a lot of soccer when they were growing up, and they've got a bunch of old beat-up soccer balls. And when they're working out anger, they go to the basement, and they take an old soccer ball, they find an empty wall in the basement, and literally destroy that ball against the wall, kicking it again and again and again. You can do similar things with, if you don't have access to those things, an old rolled-up magazine or old rolled-up newspaper, and beat a mattress with it. Just destroy it and let your words come out, too. I know that I'm through the anger for today when I can't hit any longer and I can't yell any longer. All I can do is fall on the floor and sob. I might have to go there again tomorrow, but that's when I know that I'm through the anger for today. That is the moment at which God's presence becomes almost tangible. can almost feel his arm around your shoulder, holding you while you're lying there on the dirty garage floor sobbing. Speaking from personal experience, I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's so powerful, those examples. You know, I think sometimes with this concept of anger, people lean in the, just write an angry letter and burn it. That tangible physical release to exhaustion. I love that that was the example that you gave for yourself and also for other people. You know, I'm sure there's people listening. They're like, I have a magazine and a mattress. I'm going to turn this off, go do that. But I mean, they're giving people license and space to express, and like you said, in safe ways, but they're still able to rage. You know, that's such a powerful term, and they're in that almost righteous rage in a way, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's genuine. It's real.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure depleting that helps bring some clarity too, right?
Because that's when some of the insights start to happen. Mm-hmm. Sometimes those are in prayer. Following that, sometimes those are just in some realizations. Often those are, and if you can have somebody with you when you're doing that hitting or that kicking or whatever, that's when a very wise, caring person might be able to just ask a simple question that, oh my gosh, now I get it. The insight happens at that point.
Oh, that's so good, Mark. That's
so good. There's one other thing, though. The person who forgives the individual that they've been fixated on, and the fixation turns into maybe an overconnection. There's a difference between forgiveness and reconciliation, and maybe there are some situations where reconciliation can happen, but please don't go into those alone. The proverb says there's wisdom in the counsel of many, and to have a few people who you're talking with, if you're going to have any contact with the person who caused the loss, be very much in touch with some people who can challenge you, encourage you, challenge you, understand you, and hold you accountable to some things, can speak some wisdom into your life. Mm-hmm. Really encourage that. Okay. So many of the things that we're talking about around these special problems have to do with opening up to somebody trusted in a situation where that's harder than ever to do. And it's just really valuable.
Have you seen, you know, when people aren't sharing, right? They're kind of going the opposite way. They're isolating. They're really kind of closing down from whether they have an existing support system or not. Do you see that change how they grieve or how their symptoms show up in terms of things are more extreme when they aren't sharing?
Actually, most of those people I don't see because they're not sharing, and they're not sharing in their peer relationships, and it's less likely they're going to be opening a professional relationship to do that sharing in. They tend to disappear into the woodwork. When they do share, finally, if they do, it's with a lot of embarrassment, a lot of shame, which is, I understand where that comes from, and sharing with somebody who accepts you in all that it can really free the shame and the embarrassment. When confess our sins to one another so that we may be healed. I'm not implying that somebody who is just opening up in a grief situation for the first time has been in sin. I'm not implying that at all, but just the example of opening up so that we can be healed. A lot of freedom happens at that point. When I share something with somebody that I was really reluctant to share, and it's a confidant, it's a person who honors what I'm sharing. Oh man, the freedom that comes from that, all of a sudden, whew, do I feel relief. It's a very real dynamic.
Tell you what, I can relate to that entirely. When I first joined a grief group, it was, I thought I had grieved. I thought I had shared, but really I was just kind of stuffing all of those emotions. And I'm going to be strong. I'm going to be strong for the people around me. And, you know, but there's symptoms and things start to break down. And the first night that I shared about my loss and suddenly crying that I hadn't been doing just came pouring out, and all of the sharing came out, and feelings that, you know, I hadn't even articulated up to that point were coming out. And the physical lightness that I felt after that event from, you know, the actual crying itself for someone who wasn't a crier. And then also just speaking the words and unburdening some of that grief. Gosh, it was just like someone released the pressure that had been building within me.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, you mentioned some of the shame and the stigma. And again, all of these special problems in grief kind of all have their own markers. Suicide, how you shared about suicide, this accusation against the survivor, that they're personally responsible, and even kind of that element of grief, the bargaining of why didn't I notice something sooner? And for many parents that we see, there are previous attempts leading up to this, right? Yeah. And so they all kind of merge together with, we could have done more because there were attempts, you know, things like that. And so there's a lot to unravel there. And we don't have a magic phrase, right, that will ease kind of some of these feelings and these experiences. So let's start for the, for if there was a previous suicide attempt and then they were successful. And so some of the thoughts and some of the feelings that are swirling around in new grief specifically, so 6 months and under, let's say, walk me kind of through for that person, like, how would you start to, you know, they're hearing some of these things that you described around, you know, the accusation piece, and why didn't I notice? How do they start unraveling that for themselves of, this is where I'm at, this is how I think, and I want to get to someplace different on how I view the suicide?
I want to talk about a couple different aspects of that, and there's one very specific situation that I'll mention, and I won't say enough about it that anyone could be identified. There was a suicide I became aware of. I was asked to intervene with the family, and the person who died had a considerable conflictual history of mental illness from several different perspectives, and some other things that would stigmatize them as well. And in talking with a survivor of the suicide is the one who's left behind, someone who has lost the person to suicide. It was clear that significant attempts had been made to help the person, and I looked after listening for about a half hour, I looked at the survivor and I said, you know, the miracle isn't that your loved one died by suicide. The wonder is that you're able to keep this person alive for as long as you did. Now, that's one situation. The other one that you were asking more specifically about, hindsight is 20/20, and we Monday morning quarterback ourselves to death. I think I would, if I'm that person, I would want to get some, at least some help, if not some professional help, because there are some therapy techniques that are really beyond the scope of what we can do here tonight, in the cognitive behavioral realm, that can be very powerful eventually. Not as, and the reason I'm not going to share them right now is because they're not quick fixes. They are, and if I were to share what some of those things are, people would try that and that's just not going to help. But in the context of exploring a number of beliefs about oneself, about the person who died, some of the cognitive behavioral techniques or interventions can be very valuable. that's in the context of a relationship in which a lot of exploration of the feelings and thoughts has happened. There are also some spiritual implications there and some spiritual factors. If we've done something wrong and we go back and we look at it and we've done everything we can to process it and we still believe we've done something wrong, we gave up or we quit or we, whatever word you want to put that could be translated into some form of sin, there is forgiveness. If God can forgive us, then that's a pretty good authority for being eventually finally able to forgive ourselves and each other in our family if there are family interactions that are going on there.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
But again, I want to be clear. There are a lot of thoughts and feelings to explore, embrace, cry through, anger through, wade through, slog through, and finally reach some places of insight and understanding.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like the solutions wouldn't necessarily be the same. And I use solutions kind of casually, knowing that there is not a fix for this. You know, you're not broken, you're grieving.
Yes.
But specifically spouse survivors of a suicide. So, you know, for them, there's so much of this 2020, but also then this relational weight of, I wasn't enough to keep them here, or I wasn't a good spouse, you know, and some of those really deep rooted things where, let's say, a suicide of a child, maybe they don't have some of those same thoughts, and they might, but, you know, largely when we have spouses come through our grief group who have lost their partner to suicide, those are the first things that we hear about. I wasn't enough.
I wasn't enough. Yeah.
And so where do they start with that? You know, so much of what you just recommended, I think, is kind of the playbook for, here's kind of point A. But with that phrase specifically of, you know, I wasn't enough, or as a spouse, I wasn't enough, kind of how do we encourage that person?
First of all, we don't argue with them. They may eventually conclude that they disagree with what they originally said, that I wasn't enough. But we don't argue with that. We don't. Yes, you were. You're a nice person. No. We accept that. We embrace that. And we let them talk about that. Talk about the ways in which you weren't. You don't see yourself as being enough. And explore those and do empathy with those and cry with them. And that right there that's more than a 1 hour thing. That's a journey in itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What other ways weren't you enough? What other ways weren't you? And help them explore it fully. Give them that gift, that freedom. Even if you totally disagree with them, that's not what this is about. This isn't about an argument or trying to convince somebody. This is about letting them walk through those things. And that same place I talked about getting to with a punching bag, where I can't yell anymore, I can't hit anymore, all I can do is fall on the floor and sob. You've gotten close to that place with that person when they've been talking and talking and maybe talking for repeated sets of times, and then finally they just lose it in sobbing. You're getting close to where they've gotten that out.
Mm-hmm. And with any of these losses, this element of secrets can kind of be woven into any of these,
right? Absolutely.
The sudden death or the suicide. And so suddenly there's a affair or a bankruptcy or an addiction that is coming to light. And
yep.
So you never had the opportunity to process this with them in person. So you're not only grieving, but you're also blindsided by this secret that is now out. And I'm sure to an extent comes with some of its own stigmas. And, you know, one of the things that you had mentioned is that for the person who is grieving, that there's less freedom to express feelings. And, you know, going back to kind of the crux of all of this, which is have someone you can talk to, right? Like start to work through some of this. When they are grieving not only the loss, but this certain betrayal of whatever the secret is, do you see that as processing two separate things, or are they commingled?
Well, they're certainly commingled, but that's grieving two separate things. And absolutely, it's commingled. And you're going to see somebody go back and forth between those. And that's fine. They are commingled. They mm-hmm. absolutely are. You're grieving if you've learned about an addiction or an affair or something that you didn't know about before. You are grieving not just the loss of the loved one, you're grieving the loss of trust. You're grieving the loss of naivete. And that could just go on and on.
Mm-hmm.
So those things are all worth grieving. And something else just came to mind, and I hope it fits here. Sometimes there may be a suicide or a death, and we just don't ever understand it. There are homicides where the perpetrator is never found, never identified. Not just wasn't successfully prosecuted. The police know that guy did it. They just can't prove it. But the person was never identified. There's a homicide in Cincinnati right now, just happened 2 days ago, where, to my knowledge, there's been no perpetrator identified. It's a fairly public one. It's been in the news quite a lot. Comparing it to a wartime situation, if a loved one is killed in battle and is brought home with the flag over the casket, that's just hard enough as it is. But you have a body. You have something that's, yes, this I see. When someone is taken prisoner of war and you learn that, yes, your loved one is a POW in the enemy's prison camp, that there's nothing easy about that. But when you have an MIA, a missing in action, so you've got a body or a POW missing in action, where is my son? Where is my father? Where's my husband? Where's my wife? We don't know. Were they killed? We don't know. Were they taken prisoner? We don't know. What? Missing in action. And what I'm trying to do is compare the situation where we don't know why the person died by suicide, or we don't know who the perpetrator was, or why the person was killed. We don't know. We're grieving two things there. We're grieving the loss of life, and we're grieving the loss of any meaning or understanding of why the life was lost.
And that's, there's just no one size fits all. There's always layers. There's always complications. And, you know, the way we lost them, or some of these unanswered questions, just further complicates how that journey goes,
absolutely.
Right? It's never that linear straight line. With the death of a child, and you were talking about the future, in all of these circumstances, we're really focused on the person who is grieving.
Yes.
And yet, more often than not, when there is a death of a child, there's other children involved too. And so you have the parent in a place where, you know, we've been talking to them as you're grieving you, but sometimes that almost feels like a luxury, right? Like, I can't grieve my child the way I want to because I'll fall apart and I have these other children, right, that I need to be strong for. I'm worried about their grief journey. And so there's kind of the two things of one, putting their grief on hold, and then two, just trying to be hyper-focused on the children as well. In the context of working with a professional, do you recommend that the parent goes with the other children that are grieving the loss? Like, kind of walk me through how you would navigate sending, you know, as we recommend counselors and whatnot to that group specifically of a parent with other children grieving the loss of a sibling.
It really depends, depends on how old the siblings are, their understanding of death. Up to a certain age, death isn't final. Honey, there's no easy way to tell you grandpa died last night. If honey is 4 years old, okay. Well, is he coming for dinner Sunday? I mean, and that's the way a young child processes grief. And so it depends on the age of the children, the siblings. I would want the children, the siblings to have some sort of resource, preferably with the parent, the surviving parent or parents, if possible. And because their needs are going to be different, let me say it differently, because the parent's need is going to be different than the sibling's need, that parent deserves and needs some individual time with somebody as well. Mm-hmm. So both and a lot depending on the age of the siblings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, we have whole episodes where we talk about suicide and then also the suicide of a child, right? Or just the death of a child. These are just such big topics, like all grief, but this one feels especially hard because of other children in play and, you know, life still has to go on. And, you know, we feel it so deeply, like so many losses. So in those early stages, and again, we focus so much on early grief, even though we know we have people that they're 10 years out from their loss and it might still feel like they're day one. You know, if a parent notices some of those gaps, some of those walls really forming in their relationship with the remaining children, whether it's because of their own grief, whether it's the children's grief, you know, there's just, it's coming in from all different places, you know. How can we give them a playbook of 1, 2, 3, of just kind of what are the next steps? Because I think that when there's other people involved, and again, they're blinded a little bit by their own grief fatigue and focused on other people and logistics, kind of how do we help them navigate those early 1, 2 steps of here's where we start?
We know that in a family where there is a special needs child, the divorce rate skyrockets. And it's not because the husband and wife are fighting over or angry at each other about something because they have a special needs child. It's because the special needs child requires so much time and energy that the marriage doesn't continue to get built into. And it's not that the couple is mad at each other. They just drift because every good marriage requires continual building into continual work, continual investment. And when you're dealing with a special needs child, a lot of the energy gets focused on the child rather than the parent's relationship. And so extended family members move into the neighborhood where the parents live, or the parents move into the neighborhoods with extended family members. And if there aren't extended family members available or trustworthy, then that's where church groups form with the mission of giving those parents of the special needs child extra time away from the child. And so those extended relatives, when they can be trusted, or the close friends in the church small group or other small group, when they can be trusted, ensure that the parents of the special needs child get more weekends away than even a normal couple would need, more date nights than a normal couple would need because they need that time and energy to build into each other and build into the marriage relationship and not just the special needs child. I don't think that's any different when there's the death of a child. If the parents are needing to take care of and process things with the kids who are still there, the siblings, they're going to need some time just by themselves. And if that's a single parent, alone or with a good friend, weekends away, date nights, evenings out, whatever, where they can be confident that their other children are being taken care of. And I'm talking about date nights and weekends away, but I'm also talking about opportunities to grieve. Mm. They need that time and space. Put the face mask over yourself before you. Yep. Well, you can only, to a certain extent, do that in a sudden grief situation, even in a situation where you were expecting the loss. You can only do that to a certain extent. If you do have other children to care for, and you need to do that at some point and get help from some people who you can trust to take care of your kids while you go do that. Whether that's an appointment with a professional on a basis for a while, or whether that's a weekend or weekends away or evenings away, just to go out and get in front of that punching bag to go and throw stones into a creek, to go and talk and grieve and cry and everything else.
Yeah. You touched a little bit on miscarriage. One thing that I think gets a little overshadowed, and again, pulling from what we hear most in grief groups, I want to talk about the husbands and the men that are going through miscarriage with their partner or wife. So often we hear that their primary focus is, I'm just taking care of her. I want to get her through this. Mm-hmm. I want to help her heal physically. And so there's kind of the first tier of their men's grief tends to look different than females. And then you have this disenfranchised type of loss where, you know, they may not feel like they can talk about it, or, you know, their friends may not even be aware of, should I talk about this or not? Yeah. And so there's a lot of limiting factors in isolating men who are grieving a miscarriage. Tell me a little bit, where do we start with them?
First of all, before even talking about the man, I want to talk about the mother. I'm a father. We have two kids. I've never lost a child. But I think I can say pretty confidently that I don't know what it's like to carry a child for 9 months. And I could never experience what it's like to lose a child, to miscarriage, to stillbirth, to some of the most difficult situations that I've had the privilege of intervening with, where Mom knows she's carrying a dead baby and it can't be delivered yet. And it's a process. And I can never experience that. And so I can never know. This is to the mothers who are grieving. Now, your husband, your partner can never really know what that's like. If we would have lost a child to miscarriage, would that have affected me? Oh my gosh. Probably not to the degree it would have affected my wife. But it would have absolutely affected me. Now, some mothers are in the position where the truth is it really isn't affecting their husband very much. I see that. And I'm not trying to be insensitive to that. And what you've described absolutely is a dynamic as well, where the husband's beer buddies or golfing buddies or whatever, they don't get it. Can he talk to them about, well, they're not going to get it. And so I'm just going to take care of her. The same thing I'd say to anybody who is not yet or finding it difficult or finding disappointment in sharing what's going on with somebody else. Don't give up. If this golf partner doesn't get it, talk to another person, talk to another buddy, talk to another another group member, talk to another father. And I think we need to encourage them. We do need to encourage the dads to do that.
Mm-hmm. As we wrap up, you know, with this idea of don't give up on finding your person to talk to, as we described tonight, there's so many types of grief that come with their own complications. And I think kind of as a blanket statement of regardless of your relationship with the person you lost, some of them, it was ugly and it was painful. And on some level, you're glad that this is over, you know, and that you're on a healing place, or it's someone that you love deeply, whatever the relationship is, I kind of put that to the side. And the work of finding someone to talk about your grief with, you personally are worth that. You are worth navigating that grief journey, because we've seen on the other end when people don't deal with that, and just the ramifications in our life that can go for years.
Yeah, you are worth it, and it is worth it. Both of those things.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, tonight. My privilege.
Surviving Grief is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio. If you'd like to connect or share your own story, reach out to us at podcasts@crossroads.net. That's podcasts with an S at crossroads.net. We'll see you next time.